Welcome to the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast, where educators go to find inspiration and learn world-class strategies from top leaders across the globe. Better Leaders, Better Schools was created by Danny Sunshine Bauer.
This is episode number 130 with Carrie Gallagher. Hi there, my name is Danny Sunshine Bauer. I'm a former classroom teacher and school administrator turned life and leadership coach. I'm also the host of this podcast where each week I share my conversation with top leaders across the globe to help you accelerate your leadership development. In today's show with Carrie Gallagher, we explore a number of interesting topics like the book Carrie hands out the most, the strength of a discussion that leads to no clear answer, and more questions, how to build sustainable and authentic mentor relationships. And Carrie also shares two resources available in the show notes on digital citizenry and digital portfolios. Thanks for spending some time with me listening to this podcast. I hope you enjoy the show. But before we jump into the episode, I'd like to take some time to thank our show sponsors. I'd like to share an amazing free resource for all listeners of the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast. It's the Top 10 School Fundraising Ideas for 2017. And that's available at schoolzonepodcast.com. And just like the title says, you get the top 10 school fundraising ideas for 2017 at schoolzonepodcast.com. A sought-after speaker and writer, Carrie Gallagher's full-time job is as digital learning specialist at St. John's Prep in Danvers, Massachusetts. She's also the director of K-12 education for ConnectSafely.org and an EdSurge columnist. Carrie's passions and the focus on her work include empowering teachers, students, and parents to learn with open education resources, educating school communities about the power and privacy concerns that come with social media use, and diving headfirst into learning more about new and effective practices in education. Carrie received the 2014 Yale Lynn Hall Teacher Action Research Prize for her submission on the use of mobile devices for a paperless public school classroom. In 2015, she was a PBS Learning Media Digital Innovator. The Family Online Safety Institute recognized her with Outstanding Achievement Award, and she was a MassQ Featured Educator. In 2016, she was an ASCD Emerging Leader and received the MassQ Pathfinder Award. Carrie speaks and presents often at conference locations that have included Harvard Law School, Yale School of Management, and Stanford University. She holds a BA in politics from St. Anselm College and JD from Massachusetts School of Law. Her multi-award-winning blog can be found at carriehawk02.com, and we'll link that up for you in the show notes. Carrie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Daniel.
Absolutely. And let's go way back when, Carrie. What inspired you to pursue a career in education?
So ironically, I wasn't going to become an educator up until about my senior year in college. My focus was on politics, and that was what I studied. And I did quite a few internships for political candidates, both in high school and college. But when it came time to start choosing my courses later in my college career, my electives, really, I found that the one issue that continued to come up in politics, and this is still true today, is education. And so I thought having a good basis for understanding the education system from that perspective would be good for me. Well, I ended up doing some student teaching my senior year in college and, of course, fell in love with being in the classroom in that teacher role and never really looked back. I was hired by the school that I did my student teaching with and haven't left education since.
I can absolutely relate to that falling in love with teaching when you go through that student teaching experience. Do you remember exactly what about it had you fall in love?
I think it was that I had the opportunity in my student teaching to teach civics and U.S. history. And since that had been a focus of my own studies in college, because it was something that I was passionate about, having the opportunity to instill that kind of passion in the teenagers that I worked with as a student teacher, it really fed my own energy and it increased my level of passion for that content. And it turns out that teenagers are really fun to hang out with all day. Sometimes I think in broader society, they get a bad rap, but there's no one I'd rather spend every single day with than a group of teenagers who are learning something new, trying something new, working hard together. It's great fun.
I love this quote that says, "What is ordinary to you is extraordinary to me." So Carrie, what would you consider your superpower?
My superpower. I think one of my superpowers, at least as an educator, is when I hear some of my colleagues talking about something that they've read or something that they've heard, being able to pull a book off the shelf in my office and just drop it on their desk with a little sticky note and saying, hey, I heard you mention this idea. Check out this chapter in this book or check out this author. They expand on it. And I think, you know, we can chat more later. And I found that just by, you know, doing that really subtle information sharing, it's led to building some great relationships with the teachers I work with, but also it's led to some awesome conversations where we've learned a great deal from one another. So I think one of my superpowers, at least within my school, is making those connections for people.
I love to read, and so do the listeners of this podcast. And I'm wondering if you have a short story of maybe a recent time you shared a book, or is there a book that you share, recommend the most?
So right now, the book of mine that's going around our school is called An Ethic of Excellence by Ron Berger. It's a short read, and it's been around for a little bit, but it's incredibly uplifting and powerful. And one of the things that he does is tell great stories about his own students and his own classes. And it came about because of a middle school faculty meeting. My school is a 6 through 12 school. So our middle school faculty came together at the end of last school year to talk a little bit about the homework policy. There's a little bit of tension in any homework policy. How much is too much? How much is necessary? How much is not enough? When is homework valuable? What type of homework is valuable? And so they decided to kind of develop a working group discussion. And as a result of it, a math teacher just stopped in my office one day afterwards and said, you know, that conversation really made me think differently about the type of work I assign. And I think I'm going to start assigning homework that's based really on more real life scenarios and less on just practice problems. And I said, you know, what you're talking about reminds me of this book. And I handed it to him, The Ethic of Excellence by Ron Berger. And he read it. It was right before summer, and he went off on his summer vacation, and I was still here at work. And a couple of weeks later, I got an email from him out of the blue. And he wrote this whole long email about some of the things that Berger says that really inspired him. And he asked if he could share what he learned with his colleagues. And so a fellow coach and I at my school run a kickoff conference for our teachers that we call Jumpstart in the middle of August. And we invited him to be what we called a lightning speaker, so a quick 5-minute talk. And he shared his takeaways from that book and shared how he's going to change his teaching practice as a result. And now that book has been picked up by 3 other people in the school, and it seems to be making its way around. Honestly, if I never get that book back, I won't mind, because it's clearly having an impact, which is a great thing.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I want to try to summarize that story and really pick out the parts for the listeners. But what I heard is that you had these discussions, I'm not sure if they're formal or informal, around homework. And it's not that you were trying to force some type of point of view down the faculty's throat, right? But you were just having a discussion and engaging in critical thinking. And from there, a colleague came by and said how much they enjoyed that discussion. You handed out the book, which inspired him to take his learning to another level and own it, right, himself. And from there, you gave him a platform as well as part of being a lightning speaker then to share off to a broader audience, which I think even really cements or solidifies that ownership of this whole piece you started through an investigation and discussion.
Yeah, and I actually wasn't there for that initial discussion about homework, but I heard about it quite a bit from other people because they left the discussion without any real clear answers about what homework is valuable. But they left, as any good discussion results, and they left with more questions. And depending on their questions, and in this case, this particular teacher, it reminded me of this particular book. And like you said, he developed an ownership and decided to share further, and it's continued to grow.
The other key part too is we have to be comfortable as leaders to not have to, A, have all the answers, right? And be comfortable that there's not a clear answer. And it might actually, a great discussion might lead to more questions where people might feel a little more, at least initial, unease around whatever topic you're tackling. But that leads to that deeper learning and the true transformation that you're trying to establish within your organization. That's a really beautiful story you just shared right there. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah.
Yeah. The strength of a discussion that leads to no clear answer, more questions. I'm just like almost out of breath and out of words after you shared that, but I really, really enjoyed it. That's a positive story, Carrie. So I'm wondering if you don't mind sharing what you consider your worst leadership mistake and what you learned from it.
You know, I think that I actually just had a meeting with a colleague right before I hopped on this call with you. And it was because of a mistake that I made on Friday. And so I said, you know, we need to chat on Monday morning because I need to sort of get to this quickly so that it doesn't create any problems in our relationship. And really what it was is I thought that I had clearly communicated something and I didn't. And as a result, I mean, obviously when things are mistakes, they're hard to talk about, right? Yeah. As a result, that the work that I do with that particular colleague suffered on that day. And I wasn't really able to express what I needed or how that person could help. But over the weekend, upon reflection, I was able to kind of own my own mistakes in that situation. And I could express to that person. And really, it's really interesting, to be honest, I just had that discussion and the person said, I really had no idea. And I said, I know, it's because it was my fault. I didn't communicate it effectively and you did everything right. But you should know that this was going on behind the scenes. And I'm like owning this mistake with you right now so that, you know, I'm being fully transparent and letting you know what happened. And it was a project I've been working on for a couple of years and have felt some real deep ownership on that project. And as we're kicking off that same project this school year, that other colleague kind of stepped in and took it over. I hadn't claimed any official ownership on the project. I hadn't expressed to that colleague that I really wanted to remain the lead and remain invested. And so that person had no reason to think that they weren't doing the right thing. And the work that that person is doing on the project is phenomenal. And so I've decided that I need to let that go because I think the project will benefit, but also I need to be clearer in the future about how my involvement and how other people's involvement can affect the work that we do.
I don't know about you, but I had enough on my plate just thinking about how to operate a building and how to develop my people. That was enough. And that doesn't even include parents. That doesn't even include student issues. And it definitely doesn't include where am I going to find the funding to run all the great programs my students deserve. Well, the great news is I have an amazing free resource for you, the top 10 school fundraising ideas for 2017. That's available at schoolzonepodcast.com. In this guide, you will be exposed to the best fundraising ideas for schools in 2017. And my favorite company that's described in the guide is School Spirit Vending. The reason School Spirit Vending rises above the rest is because they make fundraising so incredibly hassle-free. What if a company would come in, install vending machines with customized stickers. That's right, stickers that had your logo, that had your mascot, that had whatever you and your students wanted installed. They come in, they take care of the machines. You do no work besides having the machines installed in the school, and you get a cut of the profit. That's where you're going to find money to actually run these programs. So check out the top 10 school fundraising ideas for 2017 at schoolzonepodcast.com and definitely give School Spirit Vending a call. Tell them Danny Sunshine sent you.
That's so interesting. You said your colleague stated that you didn't even know. So a lot of it, you know, you realize, like you said, upon some deep reflection over the weekend. What is it about you that you wanted to, I guess, make things right and clear things up? Because probably the temptation for a lot of leaders might be, hey, if people don't know that I made the mistake, I'm just going to let it slide, you know? But you wanted to make it right and make sure that the communication was at some type of gold standard, right?
Right.
So you weren't going to just let it go. What is it about you that made that possible?
Well, I think it's that if I was feeling as though something had been taken from me professionally that I was invested in, and even if that other person didn't even realize, that I would still have that feeling. And so it would, as a result in the future, continue to impact my relationship with that person potentially negatively. So it's better to be fully transparent, even if it means admitting mistakes, so that the relationship with my colleague can grow effectively. She knows now that this is something that I struggle with, and so she can help support my growth in that area. And in the same way, I was able to compliment her on the strengths that she's bringing to the project now to make it better, so that she knows that I notice, you know, the good work that she does. And as a result, I think our relationship will be better. You know, she left the conversation, she left my office, and the last thing she said to me was, thank you so much for like opening up and talking to me about this. So I really think it was better for all of us for me to do that.
Absolutely. You know, when you have a colleague say, thank you so much, right? You can generally tell if they mean it or not. When they're saying stuff like that's right, you know, and you see those affirming head nods and that kind of thing, you have definitely built more trust within that relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's better to have that conversation as soon as possible. And that's why I wanted to do it right away Monday morning.
No, I like that. It'd have been eating you away. I bet you're that type of person. It would have been messing
yeah.
with you if you had not done it. Okay.
Exactly.
So, you know, you're a go-getter in that sense. I'm curious, do you have any routines or rituals that help you be more successful? Maybe that's a way that you start each morning, or maybe when you get to work, like a little routine you might have. Just curious if you have any sort of routines that help you be successful.
Well, I have two elementary age children. And so my mornings are mostly focused on making sure that they're clothed and fed before we leave the house.
Right, of course.
So I'd love to say that my morning is like relaxed and thoughtful and reflective, but it's really not, because we get up at 5 a.m. and it's rolling from there. I do have to say the like, you know, 8 to 10 minutes that I have to myself in the morning is in the shower. And I honestly get a lot of thinking and planning done in the shower for my day. And oftentimes I will already have the whole day planned on my calendar and documented. But that morning in the shower, I'll think of something to make something so much better. And I'll be so inspired. And then I can't wait to get to work to add those tweaks that I thought of. So I do take that time in the shower. I almost like it serves a dual purpose, right? Like you have to take a shower in the morning, but you can use that time to really be thoughtful and creative. And I think my brain is really ready for it at that time of day because it's been resting all night. So that's helpful. But in terms, I actually do most of my reflection and processing of how I'm doing and where I'm going at night after my children go to bed. That's that like hour and a half right after they go to bed is the time when my husband and I kind of go off and pursue our individual passions. He's a techno DJ, so he'll go downstairs and play and mix and make music.
Yeah.
And I will go to a quiet area in the house, and I tend to write. So that's why blogging has become such a passion of mine, probably much like podcasting has for you, because it gives you an opportunity to think about things, process them, organize them in a way that is helpful and reflective, and in a way that you can go back to later to remember where you were at that point. And so writing has been a big part of my professional growth. And it turns out, luckily, that people like to read my writing, but that isn't really why I started doing it. It really helps me process my day and my growth.
So it's like that long form writing on your blog. And like I said to the listeners, you know, that'll be linked up for you to check out Carrie's work. How do you pick topics? You know, is there a process then for reflection when you start a new blog piece?
Yeah. So my process for writing is, I don't know if it's different or the same from other bloggers, but generally, if there's something that's happening in the news that I think educators need to consider as they're teaching and working with students, I'll try to write about it immediately. So it's, you know, it's current. But otherwise, the topics that I write about, they kind of come to me over the course of my day as I interact with my colleagues and with students, or as I interact with my non-educator colleagues in my Connect Safely work, or some of the, you know, the conferences that I'll do work for. And I'll see how it does actually connect to education. I'll want to write it. So when I get an idea, I grab my phone and I open the Notes app on my phone and I type out the idea there. And then I'll, you know, sort of subtopics, or as the outline of the blog post develops in my head, I can hop into that app and jot things down as I go. And generally it takes a day and a half or so for an outline of a blog post to develop in my head. And then I can usually sit down and write it in an hour once I've gotten those thoughts developed. But I don't just sit, develop the idea, and then write it all at once. It's definitely something that comes to me over the course of a day.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for explaining that process. You know, as a content creator, I'm just so fascinated, right? Like how people get from the start to an end product. Your most recent post that I can see on the power of school culture for new teachers. In this, you know, by the time the listeners get to this, the post will be about 6 months old, but I will link it up in the show notes. Listeners, you could check it out if you haven't seen it yet. Was that something that you saw in the news, or what inspired that topic?
So that was inspired by two things that I didn't see. I didn't see the connection between them immediately. It wasn't until I started developing my outline. Number one, my mother, who is actually a nurse practitioner, sent me a link to this article in the Infectious Disease Advisor, which is an industry publication that she reads for her work, that was about burnout in early career teachers, the study that some university folks had done. And she said, it's funny that it's in the Infectious Disease Advisor since it's about teachers. So I thought I'd send it to you. And then also Tom Murray and Eric Scheninger recently wrote a book called Learning Transformed, which I have a copy of. And so a lot of what they talk about in that book is about the development of school culture and the role of leaders in developing school culture. And I thought about my first couple of jobs as an early career teacher, and there were schools that I worked in that had amazing culture and I felt very supported, and it felt okay to make mistakes because there were people I could talk to about them and ask for advice without feeling threatened or like I was going to lose my job for admitting the mistake. But there are also schools where I worked that if someone made a mistake, they were immediately called out publicly. There was immediately a big discussion about it, and it was really intimidating. And I thought about how that felt for me. And so I wanted to make a connection between that study and this book. Also, we have, you know, a good number of new teachers at my school. And so as I was doing this writing, I was thinking about how our school culture might affect them as they're learning our system and our students and our community. And we all want new teachers to be successful because we want the students to benefit. We want them to feel a passion for their job. And I think most personally for me, my daughter, my third grader's teacher, is a first year teacher this year. And of course I want her teacher to be successful, because if her teacher is successful, then my daughter will have a good year. If her teacher is unsuccessful, then my daughter's third grade year will be a rough one, and we can't get that back. So how can we as educators support our new colleagues in a way that helps them be as successful as possible for themselves and for their students? I think even if we're not formally their mentor, mentorship programs are important. We can be sure that we share positive ideas with them, that we encourage them when they're frustrated. You know, there are lots of ideas in that blog post, but that's where that came from.
Yeah, I love that. The mentorship piece is so key. And I think it gets swept under the rug or just sort of gets like a nod, like it's important. We know that as a school leader, and I'm going to assign somebody, but on paper, there's a mentorship relationship, but in reality, there's not. So do you have any ideas or suggestions as a school leader how we can implement real and authentic and sustainable mentorship relationships?
Yeah, I think mentors need to be trained appropriately. And the best mentors, from what I can tell, are full-time classroom teachers who are not the evaluator of the new teacher. And that there is a norm set where there is some privacy in that relationship, so that new teacher can feel comfortable, like I mentioned before, admitting errors, asking for advice without judgment. And also the mentorship program shouldn't just be that one relationship. The new teacher should have opportunities to get together. The mentor should have opportunities to get together. And there should be some really clear guidelines about how discussions are had, so that no one's, you know, confidentiality is violated. And yet people are able to get great feedback, so that when it does come time for their formal evaluation, they do feel comfortable having that administrator or evaluator in their classrooms, and their students are always benefiting from, you know, them learning and growing. Our mentorship program here at my school has grown and changed quite a bit over the last couple of years. We actually invite some of our master teachers who have retired to help run our mentorship program. So if they're here on campus once a week or so to meet with some of our new teachers, you know, they're not evaluators, they're not administrators, they're really just there to support them. And that's been valuable.
This podcast is a proud member of the Education Podcast Network. podcast for educators and podcast by educators. Listen to all the great education podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com. That's edupodcastnetwork.com. Who trains the mentors at your school?
At our school, there is one of them who's been running the program for a really long time. And to be honest, I've only been here for 2 years, so I don't know like who trained her. But she's the one who helps train the mentors and set the norms for how it works. And we use, we're starting to develop our use of protocols to help structure those discussions even more so that there are real clear norms around what information is shared and who has access to it.
Yeah, that's a great toolkit just for all the participants in the mentorship program, because you have those common expectations and then ways to navigate easy and not so easy conversations, it sounds like.
Yeah, difficult conversations are really hard, but they're so important. As I mentioned before with that conversation I had with my colleague, I knew going in this morning that that was going to be a tough one, you know? Yeah. But it ended really well because I admitted to my mistakes right away. And I think you getting accustomed and getting good at having those difficult conversations can lead to the most impressive professional growth for anyone, no matter what business or work you do. They're just so important.
It's hard to not be empathetic and relate to somebody that is willing to admit that they did something wrong and they want to make it right.
Yeah, yeah. I think it also shows that you have some confidence in your work when you say, like, I know I do good work here. This is my area where I struggle. Mm-hmm. I'm opening up to you because I want you to know that I struggle there. And hopefully our relationship can grow as a result of that.
So we've been meandering around a little bit. I wrote myself a note, so I want to go back to it before kind of going to your passion. But going back to like creating content and blogging, and I think it's important because I'd love to see more school leaders doing it, right? I really think it helps clarify your voice and really help solidify like who you are as a school leader. So the practice of it is so important. Are you familiar with the term like the imposter syndrome?
No.
So let me explain it super fast. And just let me know if I do a good job with it. But basically it's when you are putting yourself out there, right? Uh-huh. And Carrie, I'm sure you've experienced this. I know I have. And you type something up or you record that podcast or even in the beginning, right? Like, I'm just going to be vulnerable here. I knew your name was Carrie, but mm-hmm. I switched it to Callie. And then inside, I felt so bad and weird about it, right? And of course, I'm not going to say that to you. Now I am because I'm weird. But and I'm saying it to everybody on the podcast. But for a second, even though I have 2 years of content, even though over 100 episodes, even though I told you, and I'm so proud that this show gets downloaded more than 95% of podcasts that exist, right? Mm-hmm. All that makes me feel great. The fact that I called you Kelly for just a second, I'm like, who am I to be even talking to this person? Why do I have a show? That's the imposter syndrome, that terrible voice in your mind, just for a second when you don't hit save and publish. How do you deal with that?
So I don't find that I have that issue with blogging because, I mean, I started blogging in 2009, so I've been blogging for a long time. And when I started doing it, it was because it was an assignment for a graduate cohort I was in. So I started it out of like a requirement. It turned out that I really loved the process. And the fact that people happen to like what I write is like a bonus. So the writing, I don't have that much of a, I don't experience that so much because if people don't like what I write, that's okay because I didn't really write it for them. When I write as part of my own reflection and growth process. So I'm okay with that. That the imposter syndrome I have comes with my speaking because there are people who are just powerful, amazing public speakers who speak with passion about education. And I'm sure you've heard them, keynote speakers and all of that. And I would love to be that talented and I would love to be able to convey that passion to an audience, to make a whole room of people laugh, to make a few people in the room tear up, to make some people in the room uncomfortable because I say something that's a little edgy while others are, you know, cheering at the progress that I'm hoping to push forward. Mm-hmm. That have that emotional impact on a room when you're talking about something you're passionate about. I would love to be able to do it and I'm not sure that I do it yet. And I say yet because I hope to. Mm-hmm. And then, so recently I've been fortunate that I have two keynotes at pretty decent sized conferences booked for this coming fall. And I have had so many moments, Daniel, where I've been like, why did they book me? Oh my God. Like, can I actually do this? I don't know. And they booked me because they believe I can. They booked me because they've seen me speak in other contexts. I mean, you're not going to book a keynote speaker sight unseen, but I have. And then I'll also have moments like you just said, where I'll proudly tell people, oh yeah, no, I'm keynoting that. I'm really excited. You know, I'm working on the content. It's going to be great. And then I'll have moments where I'm like, why am I even telling people that I'm keynoting it? Then they're going to want to see it. And what if I fail? You know? Yeah. So yeah, I can totally relate to that.
And how do you work through it?
I think there are certain people that I can talk to about it who can settle my nerves at those right moments. One is my husband, for sure, which is great because a lot of times those moments happen like on the weekends when I'm not around colleagues and you don't want to bother them just because you're stressing out. But another is luckily there are one or two colleagues, particularly here at my school now, who I think I can really open up to about it. And I can also share some of like my plans, like my, you know, my keynote slides and stuff with them and get really honest, critical feedback from them without feeling threatened about it. And also I think becoming a connected educator has been incredibly important because there are lots of people out there who have an expertise in this, who are very willing to give you feedback and share and have really open conversations with you. So I think the most important thing when you're feeling something like that is to share it with someone who you trust, who can not share it for the sake of just saying, oh, compliment me and make me feel better, but share it for the sake of having a real, real conversation about where your strengths are, where your weaknesses are, so that you can get over the imposter syndrome and recognize that you're not going to be good at everything, but you have a talent in an area that people have recognized. You should embrace it and continue to improve it.
I appreciate you going there with me, Carrie, and exploring that topic a little bit. Thank you.
Thanks.
In the pre-chat, we talked about how your passions that help teachers and students between like using the tech to do great things, but that tension between doing the great things with a realistic, understanding of the tools. And one of those ways is how to take risks, right? With new things without overwhelming yourself as the educator or your students. Can you touch on that a little bit?
Yeah. So when I was still in the classroom, I was definitely one of those teachers who we tried a new tool every week. And sometimes I think it worked really well and other times it definitely bombed. And as a result of that experience, I tried to coach teachers to, and what I learned from it is that during my last couple of years teaching, we really developed a couple of foundational tools that were the basis for how we operated and communicated and functioned as learners together. And then we could add on some of the more flashy tools to make the work exciting, but we had to make sure they mastered those foundational tools first. And so when I'm working with the teachers at my school, I mean, often I'm one of the people bringing in the new flashy tools that really get people excited. And then, you know, after running a PD session or running our little kickoff conference for our teachers, or after meeting with a teacher one-on-one and sharing something, I'll get an email and they'll say, I want to try this, this, and this that you mentioned. How about next week? And I often have to, you know, say, okay, so what is it that you want the students to do? What is it that you want them to learn? Let's talk about which tool or tools are the right ones. It's really important to balance the importance as a teacher, to balance the importance of being a risk taker and modeling creativity and risk taking for your students with making sure your students have a reliable system that they're comfortable with so that they can learn. And so I think striking that balance is, it's a different balance for every teacher because some teachers are more comfortable with these things than others, but making sure that student is at the center of that decision is always really important. So that's been something that my colleagues and I talk, my fellow coaches and I talk a lot about when we work with teachers. We have some teachers who are, you know, go-getters, but sometimes our students get overwhelmed. And then we have other teachers who don't take risks at all and their students don't have the opportunities to be creative. So finding the right balance is really important.
Have you recognized the trend or identified some way that helps reluctant teachers to actually take that risk?
I think, you know, that group is always a group that you're trying to find creative ways to work with them, build excitement in them. It's one of the ways that I think works really well is almost like guerrilla coaching. Like
guerrilla coaching. Like, tell me more.
Yeah, guerrilla coaching, right?
Yeah.
Like guerrilla warfare, like you're hiding and you're, it's, you know, but it's not necessarily in the form of trickery so much. It's much more that those reluctant teachers always have colleagues who are risk takers, either on their team or in their department or whatever. And so those reluctant teachers are not likely to go to someone like me, a coach, and say, I want to try this. But they might, if they overhear one of their risk-taking colleagues talking excitedly about a new project they tried or a new approach that they tried while they're in, you know, their department room or at the lunch table, they might then come back to that colleague and say, hey, I heard you talking about this. Could you tell me more about it? Or could I stop by your classroom and see? So having great relationships with your teachers so that you could hear about these little connections that happen for me as a coach is important, because then I get wind of the fact that this reluctant teacher has sparked an interest in this, and I can plan to casually meet them right after class. Oh, I happen to be in the hallway outside their classroom, right? And say, hey, I heard you, you know, stopped into this person's classrooms the other day. You know, have you thought about it? Would you like to sit down and meet? And so that's why it's kind of guerrilla coaching, right? It's not sneaky, but it's meeting them where they are without making them feel like there's this great expectation that they have to meet or that it has to be an intimidating process.
Just strategy. That's all it is.
Just strategy.
I love it because, you know, you got to have multiple tools and multiple approaches. And what I hear you saying too, you understand the person you're serving, right? So the way you're going to reach them isn't what this other teacher over here will be welcome to, right? And so this guy will respond to that, this woman will respond to this, and you modify your approach. It's not one size fit all, which is so incredibly important.
You know, I'm learning. I haven't reached every single teacher, but learning more about them, finding out what makes them tick, finding out why they're a teacher in the first place is often really the key that opens the door.
Conferences, piles of flyers, getting stuck in endless email lists and never-ending calls, there's an easier way to sort through and identify the best school fundraisers. School Spirit Vending proudly presents the Top 10 School Fundraising Ideas of 2017. It's a guide of the top fundraising companies hand-picked from the best podcast. As an added bonus, this guide lists 5 resource companies that would add tremendous value to your community, school, and students. The best part is that School Spirit Vending is giving the guide away completely free. Are you ready to simplify the search? Download the free guide at schoolzonepodcast.com. What are you particularly proud of your school for accomplishing or attempting in the last few years you've been there?
So there's 2 particular initiatives that I'm really closely connected to that are still very much in progress, but I think we've made great progress and we know we have much further to go. One, and they're kind of linked. One is our digital citizenship program. So we're a one-to-one school like many others are, but I think when that one-to-one program was rolled out 5 or 6 years ago before I worked here, it was rolled out in terms of we're going to train our teachers how to use this device. We're going to put the device in the hands of all the kids and go. And there wasn't a lot of preparation for some of the pitfalls and distractions that can occur when students have access to a tool that powerful. And so our digital citizenship program has sought to address that for both our students and our teachers. Our teachers are integrating digital citizenship concepts and ideas in everything they do. So it's part of the rubric for every project. It's part of the introduction to every class at the beginning of every school year. And it's helping to frame what's an appropriate way to use this powerful device and what's an inappropriate way to use this powerful device for our students. And that doesn't mean that kids still don't fool around and make mistakes. They do. But when they make the mistakes, if they're caught by a teacher or a peer, they can own that mistake and understand why it's a mistake because they have the background. One of the things that I'm particularly proud of is that we're expanding our parent programming in this area because since our students are bringing home these powerful devices to do their homework, parenting in this age is completely different than parenting for any generation before. And a lot of times parents are like, well, you know, my school's an all boys school. So they say, you know, my son knows how to use it better than I do. So who am I to tell him what's right and wrong? So we've worked really hard to develop some norms with our parents so that they can bring in strategies so that they can bring those strategies home to talk to their son about how he uses his device. and helping them understand that even if they know more about the device, your son, they don't know more about life or about, you know, etiquette or about taking care of themselves, because you're the parent, you know more about that, and you can help them develop better habits. So I think the growth of our parent programming has been awesome, because one thing that I think it acknowledges is that education doesn't just happen in school, obviously, right? Only a small percentage of education happens in school. Most education happens outside of school hours when parents are really the ones in charge. And so we need to work in partnership with them. So that's one. The other one is our digital portfolio program. We're in our third year, and we've had some bumps, but I think every year we do it better. And it really has been a nice way to help the adults and students on our campus develop relationships that are beyond the traditional coaching relationship or the traditional teacher-student relationships. It's a relationship where the student is able to talk about his growth over time and then document that growth in a digital portfolio, so that when he graduates from our school, he'll have this whole digital record of his work starting from when he was in sixth grade and 11 years old, you know, and could barely write a paragraph, all the way up to when he's a senior and, you know, he's creating amazing like final projects, you know, orchestrating whole community service projects on his own. You know, I think I'm really proud of how that program is growing, and I really can't wait to see what our students graduate with in a couple of years when it's been around now for a while.
Love it. Thanks for sharing those two accomplishments. I'm not sure if you have any like sort of overview or one pager type things that might be a kickstart for listeners of the show concerning digital citizenship or digital portfolios. But if you do, I'd love to link them up to the show notes of the show and you know, make that accessible to the listeners.
So for digital citizenship, my colleagues and I built a website called digsitsjp.weebly.com. And that would be what I would consider an outline of our program. And we continue to add to and edit that website as our program grows. For portfolios, I could share something with you after the show. We actually, one of my colleagues and I did a presentation at ISTE based on our program. And so I could share some of the work from that with you.
Awesome. And we're sharing that with the audience. That's incredible. So listeners, you know, just click the show notes and you'll be able to get to the resources Carrie just described. We'll link them up for sure. Just to wrap up, a few fun questions and then one big one at the end. You talked about An Ethic of Excellence as a book. Is there any other book every principal should read right now, and why?
Oh, wow. So many. How do I pick one? I think I also talked about Learning Transformed. I think the focus on school culture in that book is essential and important to help any school make progress and grow and shift and change with the changing, you know, political climate, that's changing technology, changing education standards, just having your school be able to manage and handle change starts with that really solid school culture and open communication. I also right now think a great couple of books that anyone should read, Blended from the Clayton Christensen Institute, is phenomenal. It really gets at the importance of blending technology tools with real personal relationships and how that can really shift the way students and teachers interact. And to support that book, Blended Learning by Catlin Tucker and Blended Learning in Action by Catlin Tucker, Tiffany Wyckoff, and Jason Green have some real practical tips on how to implement that in classrooms and how to scale it at a school level. So those are some of my favorites that I keep coming back to in my work the past couple of months.
Carrie, what do you do for fun?
I downhill ski. I'm a downhill skier.
Awesome. And if you could be automatically good at something, what would it be?
I could be automatically good at something. What would it be? I always want to be a better parent. I wish I could be, you know, parenting is hard and I think I do the best I can, but if I could just be really good at it and nail it every day, every hour, I wish I could do that.
What message would you put on all school marquees across the globe if you could do so for just one day?
Something about, you know, take risks and then share your mistakes, right? We want people to try things and not always play it safe, but we want them to share what they learn from taking those risks so that other people can benefit from it too.
You made it. This is the last question.
Carrie, you're building a school from the ground up. You're not limited by budget or resources. Your only limitation is your imagination. How would you build your dream school and what would be your top three priorities?
Oh my gosh. So I would want to build it in a place that has lots of different seasons and environments nearby, like within a day trip distance, so that students could experience learning not just at the school, but, you know, near the ocean, in a desert, on a mountain, you know, in a rainforest. So if I could somehow have, you know, since the budget's unlimited, maybe I could bring in some scientists and climate experts to make sure that all those are accessible to my students. Because I really believe that what the formal learning that happens inside a classroom is just a drop in the bucket compared to what our children learn over the course of their lives. So that would be really important. Having spaces that are both open and airy and bright, but also spaces that are really quiet, encourage solitude available to teachers and students would be important. I think collaboration is great, but also time for thoughtful, calming reflection is just as important. So a space that would have that. And then finally, I would want my students and teachers not just to have access to all those environments and spaces, but access to experts. So I would make sure that we have, you know, areas where there can be guests that we can maybe even put up that can stay at our school for a week at a time to visit with our students, but also the technology needed to bring people to us if they can't be with us physically. So we'd have lots of, you know, maybe augmented and virtual reality labs so that people can visit us virtually if they need to, or we can visit them virtually. I just would want to make sure that the physical plant of the school doesn't limit the learning to the physical plant of the school. That would be my priority.
Mm. Well, Better Leaders, thank you for investing in yourself today by listening to this podcast. Remember that life's 10% of what happens to you and 90% of how you react to it. Go out there today and be a better leader. Today's podcast was brought to you by Daniel and Carrie. Be better starting today by heading over to betterleadersbetterschools.com. Type Carrie in the search bar, show notes page will pop up. You get the highlights of today's episode, links to all the resources, including Carrie's Twitter account to connect with her, and the best way to connect. Carrie, thank you so much for sharing your leadership insights and helping the better leaders be better.
Thank you, Daniel. It's been a pleasure.
Better Leaders, just a few more things before you take off. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review the show. This helps gives the show some social proof, aka iTunes juice, and encourages new people to listen to the show. If you are a social media junkie, share your biggest takeaway from the show, and feel free to tag me on Twitter or Instagram. My handle is Alien Earbud, an anagram for my name, Daniel Bauer. Take the letters, switch them around, and create something interesting and new. That's how I got it. This Sunday is the weekend resource. Do you want to get a short email from me every Sunday where I share the best resources I have come across, links to interesting articles, books, blogs, and podcasts that have challenged my thinking, and a quote that's inspired me and will inspire you as well? If you'd like access to this resource, head over to betterleadersbetterschools.com and join the newsletter at the top of the page. Over 1,000 school leaders subscribe, and I think you'll benefit from it too. In the newsletter, I also share when a new blog or podcast comes out, as well as different opportunities to work with me. Thanks again for listening to the show.